You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. Bill Maher returns for a new season of HBO's award-winning series, Real Time with Bill Maher, right as the 2016 presidential race kicks into high gear. And boy, does he have a lot to talk about. The new season premieres Friday, January 15th at 10 p.m. only on HBO. Again, that's Friday, January 15th at 10 p.m.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 12th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the Majority, the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ian Millhiser from Think Progress's legal, I don't know, what's justice?
Do you not have the, you
no.
have the bio?
No, can't find that sheet.
Okay.
Well, we all know Ian Millhiser.
Senior legal analyst for the Majority Report.
Well, no, I don't think that's it. But he'll be on the program to talk about Friedrich and Bobbick. Friedrich being the case that very well may be the close to final nail in the coffin of unionism in this country. And Clint Bowlick, I should say, a terrifying judge appointed to the Supreme Court in Arizona. Also on the program tonight, preview of tonight's State of the Union address. Will Obama get booed if he mentions the TPP? Will he mention the TPP? I doubt it. Kim Davis and her lawyer will be there.
Boo.
Not a single Republican congressman is taking responsibility. They're somehow just showing up like an apparition. This is the way that she did it with the Pope, too, I think. You'll recall she is the Kentucky county clerk who feels it would be just wrong for her to sign off on marriage equality. Meanwhile, a new book details how the Koch brother patriarchs not only helped out Stalin, but, because it's a free market, also Hitler. Another story shows just how massive they are relative to the RNC in terms of their political advocacy. Democratic Forum last night in Iowa. Have some sound from that. Polls show the race is tightening in both New Hampshire and Iowa. Clinton campaign sweating just a little bit. And the roster for the Republican debate is out for Thursday night. It is a Fox Business debate. Rand Paul, Carly Fiorina, pushed to the kids' table, and Rand Paul says,
Jews.
Well, in addition to that, what is that from Dirty Dancing? You don't put what's-her-face in the corner. What is that? What was?
You don't put baby in the corner.
There you go.
Baby does not debate at the kids' table. I'm having a complete implosion. I thought I was better than my dad because I was a senator. And now his presidential campaigns are looking like Barack Obama's compared to mine. It's really upsetting.
There you go.
You know what? I don't think black people should be able to use the same bathroom as me. Boy, that's nice to get off my chest. When I thought I had a chance like a year and a half ago, I would have to be like, you know, black people are human beings and we shouldn't lock them up for drugs or whatever. And now I can get back to the good old days. Silver linings.
That is going to be interesting to see if...
gold linings.
He still has to win in Kentucky, I guess. But as a Senate, I guess he can really just now finally unleash.
Back home, Kentucky, reinstate segregation. And you don't put baby in a corner.
Folks, we're going to get to Ian Millhiser. Tomorrow on the program, we'll do a full accounting of the forum and the State of the Union with the one and only Digby. This is one of those weeks where we're just dictated by current events. More often than not, we will have guests on about books and sort of longer horizon issues. But this week we have two debates, as it were. You know, of course, the Democratic Party, I don't know if they scheduled this forum last night or even if they were responsible for the forum. But, of course, it was scheduled opposite the World Series of College Football? I don't follow college football.
Yeah, it was the College Football Championship game.
They just started implementing the playoffs. Like, what was it, last year?
I think so, something like that.
Yeah, we're real big sports people here.
I just watch it. I don't follow it.
And of course, I literally did not know about it. It wasn't even on TV. You could only get it on a Roku, Apple TV, or YouTube. But nevertheless, I did watch it after the fact. And it was interesting. nothing terribly dramatic, but the race is tightening. And so, at least in Iowa and New Hampshire, so it's going to be a fascinating couple of weeks here. I will be going, I'm 90% sure I will be broadcasting on Tuesday on the primary day in New Hampshire, and I'll probably go up there the day before to do some interviews. Generally, it's not something that I'm terribly interested in, but it could be fun, and there could be worthwhile, and there may be an opportunity for me to sit down with some Republicans, which that sounds like it might be fun to me. I wonder how long it will take until they refuse to come over, sit down. But hopefully, I'll walk
like,
that line.
Yeah, they're just like, hey, oh yeah, no, oh
right,
no, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
We'll move on.
Oh yeah, sure, no.
And then a Thursday night, we will be doing live video and audio coverage of the Republican debate. Now, it's Fox. They will shut us down, and they will shut us down relatively quickly in terms of the YouTube video. So we will definitely have the audio, and we will post the video after the fact.
Sam, can I stop by and do debate coverage with you guys?
Actually, that would be so
let's
awesome.
Let's just live streaming together. You know, screw Fox business. You don't put baby in a corner.
All right. Just want to get to this quickly because I've been teasing it for a couple of days. I'll talk about it more probably on Friday. But I've told you for years, we have an affiliate link with Amazon. It's basically a lot of people do it. It's basically if you purchase crap from Amazon, you buy it through that link at majorityreportkickback.com. We now have an option for you if you don't want to purchase stuff or you don't purchase stuff via Amazon. Jet.com. If you go to majorityreportkickback.com, we got a couple of links. We have the Jet logo there. We have a couple of links to stories about Jet so you can get a sense of what it is. But they are more than competitive with Amazon in terms of pricing. This is according to Time Magazine. They did some type of test. I mean, of course, it depends on what you buy. They deliver it to your door. They have very good business practices. I think you're going to enjoy it. So if you go to majorityreportkickback.com, you click on the jet.com link, you bookmark that, you use that as your jet.com link, and we get a kickback. Still have the Amazon link for people who insist on purchasing their stuff through Amazon, but now you have an option. And as far as I know, we're one of the first affiliates to have that option for them. So check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Ian Millhiser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, the editor of Think Progress Justice, and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, on the Friedrich versus California case that was at oral argument at the Supreme Court yesterday. We'll be right back.
Scratch a ticket with a leg of a cricket, and I got triple Jesus. Cashed it in for Siamese twin at the family firing range. I went to bed and woke up beside another man, said nobody noticed. I'm so excited the senators are fired. Don't tell me nothing's changed. Return to the moon. I'm tired.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Ian Millhiser, he is the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice, and of course the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. You can go back in our archives and find that interview we did with Ian about that book. But today he joins us following the oral arguments in the Supreme Court over Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association. Welcome to the program, Ian.
It's good to be back. Thanks so much.
So, Ian, let's start with, before we get to the case Friedrichs, which, you know, we have been anticipating for about, 8 months now, I guess, since it was first announced that they would be, the Supreme Court would be hearing this case. Let's start with the Abood case. Tell us what that case was and what it set up, and then we'll walk us through Harris and then to Friedrichs.
Sure. So, I mean, Abood is a case from 40 years ago. It dealt with what are called agency fees. So if you work in a unionized shop, you have an absolute right to not join the union if you don't want to join the union, at least in the public sector. And you also have, the union has an obligation to bargain on your behalf. So, like, if the union gets higher wages for its members, you have to get them too. If the union gets better benefits, you have to get them too. And so this creates a problem where there are a lot of folks who, if they have the opportunity to get something for nothing, they'd say, yeah, I'd love to go get something for nothing. And so they decide they're not going to join the union. They still get all the benefits anyway. What many union contracts have to prevent this problem is they have what's called an agency fee provision. And all that the agency fee provision does is it says that the non-members have to reimburse the union for the cost of collective bargaining and grievance procedures and all the services that the union's providing to them anyway. This has been, you know, they've existed for a very long time, and the Abood decision from 40 years ago said that within the context of public sector unions, these are legal. They're constitutional, and so you could have these agency fee agreements in a union contract. Now, however, this new case, Friedrich.
Let me just hold you at Abood for a moment. So the idea is that Abood has now split this basically the dues, if you will, that are paid to a union into two aspects. One is supports political speech, union advocacy. The other supports the actual sort of the actual mechanics of collective bargaining. You got to hire lawyers. You got to do you've got to send them to go and bargain for you. And the court also found that there is a compelling interest, to have a union, have one union cover everybody, right? I mean, so there's a state interest embedded in the fact that, and that state interest is some type of peace in terms of labor relations. So it's much easier and more efficient. Is that right?
Yeah, so Abood, I mean, you're right about many of the distinctions it drew. So it drew a distinction between the political activities of the union. The union's not allowed to to require the non-members to pay for those activities. So if the union goes out and campaigns for someone or something like that, that's something that non-members have the right to opt out of. The union does have the right to at least under existing law, to ask for it to be reimbursed for the services that it's providing people, and that's what these agency fees are. That's what Abood said. The reasoning for Abood, and it was at a time where there was a lot of transition in the doctrine, and the court was trying to figure out how public employers play into the First Amendment. Because here's the situation. If the government orders me to say something, normally I can say, no, you can't force me to say something. That's one of my protections under the free speech clause. But I was a school teacher once, and there was a lesson I didn't want to teach. And my principal came up to me and said, you've got to teach this lesson. So I taught it because I was an employee. And the relationship I have when I work for the government as their employee is different than the relationship that I have when I'm an ordinary citizen. So the court was trying to figure out, how do we manage the fact that we have a First Amendment with the fact that you can't have an employer-employee relationship between the government and its workers unless the government has some ability to regulate the speech of those workers. And Abood fits into that framework. Abood says that one area where the government has a great deal of leeway is when it's, meeting with its workers or their representatives in order to figure out the terms and conditions of employment. Again, it's been the law for 40 years, and it stems from the fact that the government has to be able to manage its workplace.
Okay, I guess expanding on that as well, I mean, that deals with the, at least where the court landed in terms of the First Amendment rights, and the free rider, I guess, in addressing sort of this notion of also of compelling the payments for the operations of the union. Part of that is also that because unions are mandated to represent everyone, that it's on one hand, you can't mandate that and then say you have to do it basically for free.
Yeah. I mean, that's the practical reason we have these. And it's also, I think a big part of why the courts realize that these fees should exist. It's because there isn't a principle in our Constitution that says you get something for nothing. If a union provide you with what are often very expensive services. I mean, you mean collective bargaining. I'm part of a union. We're actually in the middle of coming up with a contract right now. And I was in a meeting yesterday. There were two lawyers there from the union that, we're constantly emailing that's what it takes to get a collective bargaining agreement together. There's a lot of expensive services that go into that. And ultimately, the people who benefit from those services, the people who get the higher salaries and the increased benefits and so on and so forth, they're the ones who should pay for it.
Right. Okay. So that's a boot. And then the sort of, I guess, that takes us up to a couple of years ago with the Harris case. Tell us about that case and what kind of bearing that has on Friedrich.
Harris was we thought that Harris was basically going to be Friedrich's. Harris presented the exact same issue as Friedrich's, which was it was an attempt to eliminate these agency fees and say that in the public sector, you just weren't allowed to charge them to non-members, even though the non-members got all the benefits of that the union got from them.
Harris was about home health care workers in Illinois.
That's right. What the court ultimately did is they drew a very fine line where they released this opinion where they had all of this language dissing Abood and saying we're probably going to overrule Abood. But then they didn't go quite that far. Instead, they said, based on this complex reasoning, that, these folks, even though they were paid by the state, they really did all their work for an individual who was the patient that they were helping out. And so this wasn't really a government employee relationship. This was a relationship between a private employer and employee. And therefore, we're not going to apply the Abood rule. So that's what the court came up with there. I think that it really was just a way station on the way to overruling Abood. I don't really think that this distinction that they drew there makes much sense. And to single out this particular group of workers in Harris, I think was quite cruel. These are people who provide day-to-day care to very, very ill people who can't take care of themselves. Care like making sure that they can eat and making sure that they go to the bathroom. And they were not paid very well. I believe they were paid a little more than $8 an hour before the union came along. And the union managed to negotiate that up to, I believe, a little over $12 an hour. So it was a very successful union. What the Harris case did was it said that this incredibly vulnerable set of workers who are underpaid and are providing the most intimate kind of care to the neediest kind of people now won't have the protection of the unions and won't have the increased wages. They can still unionize, but there's now a huge financial burden on the unions.
Right.
And in the end, that could lead, not only to these workers suffering, but, I've got to tell you, if I'm ever in a position where I need permanent care of the kind that these workers were providing, I don't want that person to be paid $8 an hour. I mean, that's some serious services that, very intimate services that they're providing. And, I want that person not to be worried about how they're going to put food on their own table. I want them to be the kind of person who, can earn more than $8 an hour.
Right. Right. This is someone you're bringing in your home to take care of your home in many respects, to take care of yourself. I mean, talk to us. I mean, and then we'll move into Friedrich's here, but this idea that the court would take a case and rule on it very narrowly, basically say we're going to find that there's none of these rights that were set up in Abood for these home health care workers, not because we're overturning Abood, but because these home health care workers are in a different category and in one where right. Abood wouldn't apply. Talk to us about this idea, because I know that this has been a theme with the Roberts Court. Well, they'll take
right.
a case, they'll use that case to lay some foundation and some groundwork, almost like a political groundwork, almost like, I got some good news, I got some bad news, you know, type of thing for you, so that the next shoe that drops doesn't have quite the same thud as it might, because there's explain that to us.
Yeah, so I mean, what I think is really going on here is that there's a principle in the law called stare decisis. It says that, generally speaking, courts aren't supposed to second-guess their past decisions. And for the most part, that's a really good rule, because we want there to be continuity in the law. We want there to be certainty in the law. If, like, I'm trying to open a business, I need to know what the law is going to be tomorrow so that I can plan for it. And if the Supreme Court's constantly changing it, that's very disruptive. And so generally the court's not supposed to make disruptive changes to the law. There are some exceptions to that. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, Plessy v. Ferguson, the segregation case, you know, when you add something that involves that magnitude of immorality, we make an exception. And then I think the other case where we make an exception is, like, if a precedent has naturally been eroded away. So, like, if you have an old precedent and, like, then there was one instance where, like, the court found it kind of unworkable in that context, so they found a way around it, and there was another instance where it didn't make sense to apply it, so they, and, you know, and finally you have, like, five or six of these cases chipping away from it build up, and you realize that the fact that the court has to keep finding ways around this precedent suggests that that precedent is a problem, and that it's, whatever rule it is out, is it something we really want to be there? What the Roberts Court likes to do is create the illusion of that natural erosion. So rather than, like, starting with the precedent, have it erode through a natural process of cases come up and the judges just realize, oh, like, this doesn't make sense in this context without necessarily having a particular agenda. What the Roberts Court tends to do is it sort of starts from the premise that it wants to overrule a precedent. But that having started from that premise, they then say, okay, well, we have to make it look like there's a natural erosion going on. So let's take one case where we just throw some language in there talking about why this precedent is bad. That's what they did in a case called Knox about 4 years ago. And then let's take another case that presents this issue, and let's stick even more in language in there. That's what they did in Harris. And now we're on the third case, and I bet you what happened is that when they overrule Abood, they cite Knox and Harris, and they say, look, our precedents have been eroding.
And even though, you know, based on the findings in those cases, it's not quite a non sequitur. I mean, that's the idea, right? It's not quite a non sequitur, but you really didn't even have to address Abood in the case of Harris. I mean, obviously, it comes up, but in terms of the way that they found it, they didn't really even have to address it. So let me ask you this, and then we'll get to Friedrich. When they are, I mean, because you can see this in a number of cases, in a number of sort of like bodies of law in which they have sort of used this approach. What happens when they determine, now, how much coordination is there, or is there just a general awareness within conservative legal circles that, look, we want to put certain cases in the pipeline to challenge certain things? I feel like they did this with the Voting Rights Act as well. We want to put certain cases in the pipeline to challenge these things. We're going to put 10, 15 out there, and we feel confident that we're putting enough opportunities out there for the four or five guys that that are our guys on the Supreme Court, and I do mean guys, that they will, they'll figure it out from there. When those justices sort of like look at those cases, how explicit is it? Or do they sit around and they grant a cert for these cases? Do they say, like, this could be an interesting opportunity to revisit Abood? Or, I mean, how does that process happen? Or are we not privy to that? Do we not know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a two-way conversation between the conservative justices and the conservative legal movement. So what happened in this case is that in Knox, the, you know, the first of these line of three cases, Alito stuck some language in there talking about how much he didn't like Abood. Alito wrote the majority opinion. That really was just gratuitous. It wasn't particularly related to the issues in Knox. And what that did was, once he stuck that language in there, that sent a signal to conservative litigators that, hey, you should bring cases asking us to overrule Abood. And sure enough, Harris shows up two years later, and I don't want to make it look like it's just, you know, a justice sends out a flag and then someone brings a lawsuit, because anti-union groups have been working for years to come up with ways to undermine unions, and these sorts of theories had existed in the lower courts. And Alito was probably aware of these theories from somewhere. That's where he got the idea to stick that language in Knox. So it's sort of a symbiotic relationship where, you know, the conservative litigators bring a whole bunch of legal theories trying to see what sticks.
And we should say, to be fair, too, he could have gotten the idea just from his Limbaugh newsletter or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Alito, I think, is the most formidable adversary we have in the judiciary. He's extraordinarily smart. He's very strategic. I think that he is aware of, like, a lot of the developments that are going on in the court system. And, like, I mean, unlike Scalia, who has admitted openly that he stopped reading, you know, newspapers that disagrees with him, that he does get a lot of what he wants to say through sources like Fox News. Alito, I think, is a very savvy general trying to marshal his forces to dismantle, to implement a very conservative agenda through the judiciary. I'm not inside his head. I don't know where he first heard of this idea. You know, it could be it could be that he's borne a grudge against Abood since 40 years ago when it was decided. It could be that he was at some Federalist Society meeting like 10 years ago and someone asked him about it. But, you know, somewhere along the way he got this, you know, someone planted a seed in his head. And he let that seed germinate until Knox came along, and then, you know, and then he dropped this.
And we should say, I mean, this is, like you've mentioned, this has been a long-term project. In 2008, I think it was, I remember being in what was supposedly a comedy show where I was interviewing Grover Norquist. And literally, talk about non sequitur, it was, what do you think of the weather here? And he was saying, public unions are horrible. And it was a real mantra, back then. So it was clearly on the agenda. All right. So that takes us to Friedrich. What is the case? What is the issue at hand, or I should say, the specific case in Friedrich versus California?
Well, I mean, this is finally the case that forces the issue of whether or not Abood should be overruled. So this is the third case in the line. I thought it was fairly clear through oral arguments that there's probably five votes to go ahead and overrule Abood. The plaintiffs in this case, I believe there are 10 teachers who say they have vague disagreements with their union and don't want to have to subsidize the union's activities for those reasons. I think one of the more telling things about the case is that there was a Wall Street Journal op-ed by one of these 10 teachers, and he listed some of his grievances. And one of his grievances, I swear I'm not making this up, is that the union keeps asking for more and more pay raises, and I don't think that we deserve the. I don't think that we should get these pay raises. So, you know, you're talking about the idiosyncratic teacher here who says, you know what, I'm paid too much money, and I'm mad that this union's trying to get me more money. Who's the person bringing this case? And, he claims that he should have a constitutional right to not reimburse this union for getting him more money.
Well, I guess different strokes for different folks. Sounds like a commie to me, that guy. But be that as it may, so give us a sense of well, before we get to what you heard at the oral arguments, give us a sense as to why there was some speculation that Scalia, of all people, because of a case in 1990, I guess it was, called Rutan versus Republican Party of Illinois. Why is it that some people speculate that Scalia might have been the one guy who was sort of the hardest for those other four justices to bring along in this attempt to reverse Abood, essentially?
Right. So, you know, the plaintiff's theory in Friedrichs is a forced speech theory. The theory is that the First Amendment doesn't allow you to force someone to speak. And so if the government enters into a contract that requires some of its workers to pay money to a union that those workers may disagree with, then that amounts to a kind of forced speech. One other thing the government could do that would look a whole lot like forced speech is they could say to their existing workers, we're not going to promote you unless you join the Republican Party and do Republican Party activities and give money to the Republican Party and otherwise demonstrate Republican views. And if you want to get hired by us, we're also not going to hire you unless you do all of these Republican things. That's basically what happened in Rutan. So Rutan involved the governor of Illinois, who was accused of basically running a patronage shop out of the governor's mansion, where he called for a total hiring freeze. And the only way to get around the hiring freeze is you had to get his explicit permission to hire someone. And the only people, it was alleged in this case, that he was giving permission to were people that were screened by this side office he set up that would, like, look at these people's connections to the GOP and see if they were Republican enough to get hired. Now, I mean, I want to be clear that, like, I think what was going on in Rutan is unconstitutional, but Scalia disagrees with me. Scalia says that in this, you know, really egregious case of the government forcing people into a viewpoint, that did not violate the First Amendment. And so it just seems bizarre for a justice to turn around and say that it is acceptable under the Constitution for us to say, we will not hire you and we will not promote you unless you are actively engaged with the same political party as the governor. But to then, after saying that that's okay, to turn around and say, but it is not okay for the government to require you to reimburse a union that is helping you get higher wages.
That is mandated to be the exclusive, because of the processes that have been followed, is mandated to be the exclusive negotiator on your behalf, too.
Right. And that isn't, I mean, like, one of the big differences between the union and a political party is, again, under Abood, the union's not allowed to spend agency fees on its actual political activity. The only thing it could spend that money on is the actual, like, nuts and bolts. Let's get a contract together. Let's negotiate. Let's let's come to terms, and then, like, handling the grievance processes. So, like, the only thing the union spending those agency fees on is on really non-political activity. It's on workplace bargaining. What the Republican Party was spending, you know, that was using that support for, and in some cases donations for, was to do political things. I mean, it is a much more egregious case than what the plaintiffs allege in Friedrichs.
How would the assuming they do overturn Abood, how would those five justices square that with, I've got to pay taxes, and I pay taxes to the city of New York, and right. New York invests money in the pension fund for their workers, and they invest that pension fund by getting an index fund, and that right. index fund includes support for, I don't know, Coke Industries, let's say, or Walmart, right. and I don't like those companies, and I don't like what they're doing. What's the deal? Or even if I'm even, or, you know, or if I am a city worker and they invest the pension funds, make it even easier. That way it's not a question of tax. They invest my pension funds for me. I don't like the way they're doing it because, so what's the deal there? How would they square that?
Yeah. I mean, it's not clear how you square it. I guess they might try to say that's a little more removed because the investment companies, like, you know, only a small portion of the money that you invest in that company is going to political activity, but, you know, none of the money that you're giving to the union and agency fees is going to political activity. It's going to workplace activity. Now, you know, the conservative justice seem to think that that workplace activity was all political, but you bring up a really great point. I mean, if the holding of Friedrichs, and this seems to be the rule that the plaintiffs are asking for, is that the government can't require its own workers to pay money if that money would go to fund political activity. That seems to be what the plaintiffs are asking for. Then, you know, if I'm a teacher or I'm a firefighter or whatever, and the pension fund or the 401k that's offered to me as a retirement plan invests in companies that engage in political speech I disagree with, I don't see how the government can require me to pay for my own retirement plan, you know, to contribute to my own pension plan or my own stock portfolio, and that just seems bizarre. I mean, the notion that it would be unconstitutional for a school district to say, hey, teachers, we've got this pension fund, but you've got to pay your share into it.
I mean, it also seems to me that, you know, at that point too, like, okay, I'm a cop and you're telling me to go out and, you know, provide the opportunity for certain people to protest. I don't like what they're saying at the protest. By my actions, right? I mean, you're directly controlling yeah. my body and forcing me. I mean, I guess that gets back into that same thing of, like, you know, the government functions as an employer in certain instances. Right. And as an employer, they say, look, part of the negotiations, you know, part of this new contract that we have signed with your mandated exclusive mandated exclusive negotiator is that part of the money goes to them, basically, to pay for that negotiation. So
yeah, and you know, and to be clear, like, the First Amendment isn't, like, it doesn't do nothing in the employment context. You know, government workers still have some protections under the First Amendment, but they're nowhere near as expansive, and nor should they be as expansive, as they are in the context of if the government actually passes a law compelling a private citizen to act a certain way. And, you know, and for very good reason. Because when you sign up to do a job, you sign up to do that job. And that means that, like, someone has to be able to, you know, command you to do certain things. And sometimes that will involve speech.
What is the status of this sort of rule in the context of private workplaces and private unions? Is it okay in those shops that are union shops in states that are not so-called right to work, it's okay for this? And is it okay because there's stricter scrutiny when the government mandates this?
Yeah, I mean, that came up at oral argument. The plaintiff's attorney in this case claims that his rule would only apply to the public sector and not to the private sector. And there's good reason to think that, because the Constitution is called the state action requirement. The Constitution, as a general rule, doesn't apply to private actors. It only applies to the government. That said, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, these folks are so extraordinarily creative in coming up with novel and like clever legal theories for having won this one legal battle, how they're, you know, what are they going to do to come up with the next one? And, you know, do you have faith that having, you know, hobbled public sector unions with the right to work regime in all 50 states, when someone presents Justice Alito with some neat new theory to also hobble private sector unions, that Alito's not going to jump on it?
Right. And we should say that this is that this ruling is maybe has the practical effect of a so-called right to work regime in all 50 states in public sector unions. But it sort of goes further than that, right? Because a right to work regime in any specific state could be repealed. This is it, right? I mean, this is basically the baseline that's being created. There's no going around this. A state can't pass a law that says, well, our state workers, we're going to compel an agency fee. That it's over if this if a boot is overturned.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, right to work laws, which, you know, they're called right to work laws. What they are is they try to set up the exact same regime that this lawsuit tries to set up, where you can't have agency fees. And they've been around at least as long as the Taft-Hartley Act, which, you know, from the 1950s. So, you know, this is a fight, and a fight that we've been having on the Democratic battlefield for 50 or 60 years now, almost 70 years now. And, you know, sometimes one side wins a battle, sometimes another state wins a battle, and, you know, but ultimately, it's the choice of the voters what regime they want to have. And if they, you know, if you want a right to work law in your state, you have the right to vote for lawmakers who will put one there. What this case is about is it's about taking that choice away from voters and basically giving it to the conservative movement.
So there's just simply no statutory fix for this, even on the federal level, right? There's no fixing the National Labor Relations Act or anything like that. This is it, done, over. Unless, do I have that right?
I mean, I'll tell you what the fix is. The fix is that Justices Scalia and Kennedy will both be 80 years old when the next president is sworn in, and if that president is inclined to appoint a justice who thinks more like Sotomayor or Kagan, then I suspect that Friedrichs won't be around very long.
Well, that's going to be the real question. It's not just necessarily having the legal disposition of Sotomayor or Kagan, but also the willingness to turn around and say, hey, that case that was decided 12 months ago, or 18 months ago, or 36 months ago, there was a big mistake made. I mean,
right. And that, I mean, that's going to be a challenge, because I think that, you know, there are justices who are going to have concerns about the Supreme Court as an institution. You know,
right.
If you read my book, I don't know why, but, you know, they're going to have concerns about not looking like they're engaging in the sort of, you know, aggressive efforts to overrule precedent that the Roberts Court has up to this point. And I guess I have two responses to that. One is you can't unilaterally disarm. But the other thing is that, like, it's one thing to say that, like, when a precedent has been overruled through, like, the natural, like, you know, the natural process that has been accepted, for recognizing that stare decisis should be overridden. You know, when you're talking of when that kind of erosion that I discussed before has genuinely happened, that's fine. But when you have these cases where, you know, the reason why the precedent was overruled the first time around is because Republicans had 5 votes, they felt like overruling it, that I don't see why you should give some, you should suddenly treat that as if it was, as if it enjoyed some kind of special protection, when, like, this decision overruling the precedent wasn't handed down through the ordinary process of law of deciding cases, right? Anyway.
Well, I certainly hope that in the event that we do have a president who will pick justices like you're talking about, they have read your book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted, so that they have that attitude. I guess my sense is, you know, we just even look at, like, you know, from a sort of a dispositional sense, you look at how long it took for filibuster reform, and there's always that tendency, I think, from people of the less than movement conservative, I guess, ilk, to tread a little bit more lightly. I hope I'm wrong about that. Ian, I wanted to get to this this appointment of Bolick, is it, in Clint Bolick in Arizona, but I think we're out of time for today. Hopefully we won't have the opportunity to talk about him in the future, but I'm afraid that we will.
I fear that once he starts handing down decisions, we're going to have many opportunities to talk about him.
All right. Well, we will put that on the docket. Ian Millhiser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, editor of Think Progress Justice, and author of That Injustice is the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Seth.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. I mean, you know, in addition to what we just heard, Ian had written about this incoming Arizona Supreme Court Justice Clint Bolick. And if you'll recall, we had an interview with Brian Beutler, I think it was in early December, maybe it was in November, about this legal conservative movement, this conservative legal movement, I should say, to bring back Lochner and or the Lochner era. And the Lochner court was a court that in the early 1900s, the aughts of the 1900s, struck down a New York state law which basically said bakers could not work more than, I think it was, 10 hours a day. And the Lochner court said, no, you can't interfere with that sacrosanct worker-employer relationship. That's freedom of contract. Ultimately, the Lochner era ended, but there are those, and apparently this Clint Bolick is one of them, who want to return to that era where not just courts, but government cannot mandate things like child labor laws, like overtime, like weekends, and on and on. Worker safety issues. I mean, the gloves are off at that point, right? When government can't say we're going to protect workers, when government can't say that we're going to in any way set minimum wage, all of those things, in a return to the Lochner era would be bygones. And so to see someone like that appointed to the Supreme Court of a state gives you a little sense of it could happen here. It could happen on a federal level. In fact, I'd be surprised if President Cruz didn't talk very highly of a guy like Bolick and say, this is the kind of guy we should have on the Supreme Court. So, and, you know, I'm going to be saying this probably more over the course of the next 12 months or 11 months, 10 months. But these two, three, four potential appointments to the Supreme Court that are, it is almost a guarantee over the next 8 years, there's going to be at least four justices replaced at a minimum. It will determine the law of the land for the next 20 to 30 years in this country. And to say that that's not relevant, I think is foolish. It's foolish. Electoral politics are not the end-all be-all. Presidential elections are not the end-all be-all. But there is a fundamental difference between the justices that someone like Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Martin O'Malley would appoint versus the ones that even Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, God save us, Marco Rubio would appoint. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. And to argue otherwise is ignorant. You could say, like, it doesn't really matter if we have child labor laws. It doesn't really matter if we have minimum wage. It doesn't really matter if we have no overtime. It doesn't really matter if we have union representation. You can say that and then say it doesn't really matter the difference between the two parties in terms of who they'll appoint. But you cannot say it matters that we have a mandated 40-hour work week and then you got to get overtime. You can't say it matters that we have child labor laws. You can't say that it matters that we can compel employers to provide basic minimum safety guarantees to workers. You can't say that and square that with the idea that this election means nothing. You simply can't. There's a whole host of other issues at the Supreme Court, but this one is the one that we're illustrating today. All right, got to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen, where we will mock some people, hopefully.
Looking forward to that.
Carly Fiorina on fire. And El Fuego.
They're all revealing. We did a sound last week of Jeb, where apparently he thinks that he won an award from somebody, and
from
he
the
won
NRA.
Neither the award or it's from right. the same person.
It's all right. That's a technical
and now
detail.
Carly,
that's a technical detail. You're getting caught up on very technical details.
I know. It's so.
What a stick in the mud. What a stick in the mud.
Everybody's doing their inner Ben Carson, except I guess Carly's always been there. Her lies are more like Trump's.
Also, we have some disgusting sound from Rick Snyder, who's a disgusting, despicable human being. We will also talk about the Koch brothers. You know, folks, how many times I've heard libertarians say, well, look, I'm not racist, and I would certainly never operate my business in any way that was racist, let's say. But the market will take care of it. And now we have the opportunity to look back on the market and see just how punished the market, how punishing the market was to Koch enterprises for not only helping Stalin, but also helping Hitler. That's not a joke. It's not one of those like.
Well, I will take my oil refinery purchasing elsewhere.
Definitely.
Sir.
Definitely.
Answer. Problem solved.
Market has worked. Folks, speaking of market, are you in the market for some coffee? JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. They don't help Nazis build refineries. They don't help Stalin. All they do is make sure that everyone gets a fair wage from the people who pick their coffee, to ship their coffee, to package their coffee, to roast their coffee, to sell their coffee, to fulfill your order when you go to justcoffee.coop, COOP. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. When you buy that Majority Report blend there, there's also tea and chocolate and other types of brands of coffee, or not brands, but, you know, styles, flavors.
Roasts.
Thank you. Places of origin, justcoffee.coop. Don't forget majorityreportkickback.com. If you buy crap from Amazon, if you want to buy it from Jet.com, 15% off your first order, apparently, at Jet. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference when you buy through those links, but we will get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. Also, it's your membership that makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. All right, folks, we'll be right back. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of this program. Of course, you can IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. Tomorrow on the program, Digby. Thursday night, we'll be covering the Republican debate. See you in a second.